Less is More has emerged as one of the most influential books in modern environmental discourse, landing on the reading lists of climate activists and progressive politicians alike. When Emma Watson shared it on Instagram as her quarantine essential reading, the book shot to bestseller status overnight. Jason Hickel, an economic anthropologist at the London School of Economics, delivers a compelling argument that has been praised by figures ranging from Greta Thunberg to Noam Chomsky. What makes this work particularly powerful is how it connects our ecological crisis not just to policy failures, but to the fundamental structure of our economic system. At a time when climate anxiety is surging worldwide, Hickel offers something rare, a clear-eyed analysis of our predicament paired with a genuinely hopeful vision for transformation. I first noticed something was wrong when I returned to Eswatini, where I grew up. As a child, our family Toyota pickup would be covered with countless insects after drives through the countryside. My father once told me that insects outweighed all other animals combined, a fact that comforted me. But years later, I realized something troubling. There were far fewer insects on car grills. This personal observation connects to alarming scientific findings. German nature reserves have lost 75% of flying insects over 25 years. French farmland birds have declined by a third in just 15 years. Most disturbingly, Puerto Rico's protected El Yunque rainforest has seen insect biomass plummet by 98% over 36 years, triggering collapse of species dependent on them. These dying insects are canaries in the coal mine of a broader ecological collapse. Climate breakdown is particularly concerning because of tipping points and feedback loops. As polar ice melts, less sunlight is reflected back to space, causing further warming regardless of human emissions. Arctic sea ice has already shrunk from 7 million to 4 million square kilometers since the 1980s. Forests face similar feedback loops. Warming makes them more vulnerable to fires, which releases carbon and reduces rainfall production. The Amazon exhales 20 billion tons of water vapor daily, functioning like a giant heart in Earth's circulatory system. If we lose it, we risk catastrophic climate shifts across the Americas. Marine ice cliff instability could cause sea level rise in decades rather than centuries, potentially submerging coastal cities worldwide with little time for adaptation. Some scientists fear we can't simply park temperature increases at 2C, as cascades could trigger an irreversible hothouse state. Our obsession with ecological disaster statistics resembles PTSD nightmares, repeated attempts to insert ourselves before trauma occurs so we might prevent it. This creates a paradoxical effect. Eco-facts urge immediate action while implying disaster hasn't fully arrived yet. The truth is, we're already living through the trauma in a dying world. Despite decades of scientific warnings, international summits, and agreements since the 1970s, global CO2 emissions continue rising. This failure stems partly from fossil fuel companies' political influence, but ultimately reflects capitalism's fundamental requirement for endless growth, an economic system organized around constant expansion with no endpoint. Unlike natural growth that reaches equilibrium, capitalism demands perpetual growth resembling cancer. The system requires minimum 2-3% annual GDP growth, creating an exponential curve that doubles the global economy every 23 years, driving resource use far beyond planetary boundaries. We've been conditioned to believe capitalism is the only possible economic system, so much so that even powerful politicians like Nancy Pelosi can only respond, "That's just the way it is," when questioned about alternatives. Yet this certainty is crumbling. A 2017 Harvard study showed 51% of Americans aged 18 to 29 no longer support capitalism, while global surveys reveal widespread disillusionment. 64% in Britain believe capitalism is unfair, and 56% worldwide agree it does more harm than good. When scientific evidence conflicts with a civilization's worldview, we must choose between ignoring science or changing our perspective. As mounting evidence links GDP growth to ecological collapse, scientists worldwide are calling for a fundamental shift. In 2018, 238 scientists urged the European Commission to abandon GDP growth as a goal. And in 2019, over 11,000 scientists from 150-plus countries advocated prioritizing ecosystems over economic growth. The relationship between GDP and well-being breaks down in high-income countries, while resources are distributed incredibly unequally. 28% of all new income from global GDP growth over 40 years has gone to the richest 1%. Scientists now advocate for degrowth, a planned downscaling of energy and resource use to restore balance with the living world in a just way. Europe's elites were outraged by the post-feudal social transformation that followed the Black Death. During the revolutionary period from 1350 to 1500, they suffered what historians call a crisis of chronic disaccumulation. With national income shared more evenly, nobles couldn't accumulate profits as they had under feudalism. The elites responded with brutal force. Nobles, the church, and merchant bourgeoisie united to end peasant autonomy through a violent campaign of evictions called enclosure. Collectively managed commons were privatized, rural communities destroyed, and peasant rebellions like the German uprising of 1525 were crushed with horrific bloodshed. This dispossession created both the initial capital accumulation and desperate workforce that fueled industrial capitalism. Contrary to Adam Smith's previous accumulation theory of hard work and saving, this was plunder that Marx called primitive accumulation. The human cost was devastating. Wages fell by 70%, famine struck, and life expectancy in England dropped from 43 years to the low 30s. While enclosure ravaged Europe, an even greater primitive accumulation occurred globally. European colonization was directly connected to the crisis of elite disaccumulation caused by peasant revolutions at home. From the 1500s through early 1800s, colonizers extracted 100 million kilograms of silver from the Andes, wealth that would be worth $165 trillion today if invested since 1800. Colonization also provided essential raw materials like cotton and sugar for industrialization. To produce these commodities, Europeans appropriated vast tracts of land and enslaved up to 5 million indigenous Americans and 15 million Africans. The United States alone extracted slave labor worth approximately $97 trillion in today's minimum wages. Beyond enclosure and colonization, capitalism required a profound shift in how people viewed the living world. For most of human history, we maintained intimate relationships with nature, seeing humans as inseparable from other living systems. Anthropologists call this worldview animism, the belief that all beings are interconnected and share the same essence. This ontology of interbeing prevented exploitation of natural systems, as people approached nature with reciprocity rather than extraction. This worldview was undermined by empires that split the world into spiritual and material realms, giving humans dominion over creation. After disenchanting nature, European elites transformed people's relationship to labor through violence and philosophy. Descartes' dualism separated mind from body, casting the body as mere machine-like matter to be controlled. This philosophy supported the 1600s campaign to defeat bodily pleasures and impose productive order. By the 1700s, idleness became sin, time became money, and profit signaled moral success. The 1600s birthed a view of nature as other and external to the economy, allowing capitalists to appropriate it cheaply or freely. Enclosure of Europe's commons and colonization of vast territories represented massive uncompensated appropriation. Resources from South America, the Caribbean, India, and Africa were extracted without reciprocity, pure theft with externalized costs. This exploitation extended to human labor. While paying meager wages to male workers, capital appropriated female reproductive labor for free. Enclosure created the modern housewife, confining women to unpaid domestic roles. Dualism positioned women as closer to nature than men, justifying their subordination. Dualist ontology permeates our modern language and thinking. We speak of natural resources, raw materials, and ecosystem services, terms that emphasize nature's subordination. Even the environment casts the living world as merely a passive container for human activity. This dualism explains our nonchalant reaction to mass extinction. We see those species as separate, not part of us. Capital operates by a fundamental formula radically different from traditional market exchange. While most people participate in markets to acquire useful things, CMC, like selling labor to buy food and shelter, capitalism inverts this logic to MCM dash, where money is invested primarily to generate more money. Unlike local businesses that might be content with steady profits serving their communities, modern corporations are structurally compelled toward endless expansion, continuously reinvesting profits to generate ever larger returns in a self-reinforcing cycle that transforms the entire economic landscape. This drive isn't merely individual greed, but a structural imperative embedded in the system itself. Shareholders and investors demand not just profit, but consistent growth, typically 5 to 10% annually, putting companies under relentless pressure to expand or risk being devoured by competitors. Companies that fail to grow see their stock prices plummet, face hostile takeovers, or get relegated to corporate graveyards. Like a virus programmed to replicate itself, capital turns everything it touches into more capital, becoming an unstoppable juggernaut programmed for endless expansion regardless of human needs, social consequences, or ecological limits. Economic growth compounds exponentially, like grains of rice on a chessboard, starting deceptively small but quickly becoming unimaginable. At just 3% annual growth, the economy doubles every 23 years and would be 20 times larger by century's end. When capital encounters barriers to this necessary expansion, whether saturated markets, labor resistance, resource depletion, or environmental protections, it violently seeks spatial fixes or technological fixes to maintain growth, often through geographical expansion, financialization, or the commodification of new spheres of life. Today's $80 trillion global economy needs to find outlets for $2.5 trillion in new investments yearly, equivalent to adding another British economy annually just to maintain current growth rates. This relentless pressure drives pharmaceutical companies behind the opioid crisis, pushing addictive drugs for profit. Beef companies burning the Amazon for pasture expansion, and oil companies bankrolling climate denial to protect their business model. Tech giants must continuously monetize more aspects of human attention and interaction. These aren't simply bad corporate actors, they're following capital's iron law of expand or die, which operates with the blind automaticity of a natural force, indifferent to its human and ecological consequences. This growth imperative explains why modest reforms and regulations often fail to address capitalism's destructive tendencies. Even when individual capitalists recognize the system's devastating impacts, they remain locked in competition that forces them to prioritize expansion over all other considerations, including human survival itself. The growth imperative intensified when governments embraced GDP as the primary economic metric. During the Great Depression, economist Simon Kuznets developed what would become GDP to help governments understand economic activity. Despite Kuznets' warnings that GDP ignores whether activities are beneficial or destructive and excludes non-monetized work, World War II's demands for maximizing productive capacity cemented GDP's importance. Today, virtually all governments pursue GDP growth single-mindedly, not by choice but necessity. In our globalized economy, nations compete desperately for investment, cutting environmental protections and workers' rights in a global rush towards self-imposed structural adjustment. The problem isn't growth itself, but growthism, pursuing growth for its own sake rather than to meet human needs. Since the 1980s, the environmental impact has been staggering. Raw material tells the story. After doubling from 7 to 14 billion tons in the first half of the 1900s, material use exploded to 35 billion tons by 1980, 50 billion by 2000, and a staggering 92 billion tons by 2017, nearly twice what scientists consider Earth's maximum sustainable threshold of 50 billion tons. The ecological crisis isn't caused equally by all humans. It's driven primarily by rich nations. While low-income countries consume just 2 tons of materials per person annually, high-income nations devour 28 tons, nearly 4 times the sustainable threshold of 8 tons. If everyone consumed at rich world levels, we'd need 4 planets to sustain us. These nations extract half their materials from poorer countries through unequal trade relationships. Coltan from Congo, lithium from Bolivia, cotton from Egypt, creating a massive net flow of resources from south to north. This mirrors colonial extraction patterns, but now operates through economic dependency rather than direct force. Despite mounting evidence connecting economic growth to ecological breakdown, growthism remains entrenched with religious fervor. Rather than accept the evidence and change course, defenders of the current system devise elaborate theories claiming technology will save us while growth continues indefinitely. The 2015 Paris Climate Agreement brought widespread relief and hope, but contains a fatal flaw. While nations submitted voluntary pledges, supposedly aligned with keeping warming to 1.5°C, these commitments collectively put us on track for 3.3°C warming by century's end, a catastrophic scenario. The disconnect stems from IPCC modelers' early realization that necessary emissions reductions would likely be incompatible with continued economic growth. Since slowing economic growth was politically unacceptable, policymakers needed an alternative solution that wouldn't threaten growth or poverty reduction goals. In 2001, Michael Obersteiner proposed BECCS, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. Massive tree plantations would absorb CO2, then be harvested, burned for energy, with emissions captured and stored underground. Despite being unproven, this negative emissions technology became central to climate planning, appearing in 101 of 116 IPCC scenarios for staying under 2°C. BECCS faces potentially fatal problems. We'd need 15,000 new carbon capture facilities worldwide to handle 15 billion tons of CO2 annually, an enormous infrastructural challenge with uncertain commercial viability. It would require biofuel plantations covering an area 2 to 3 times India's size, consuming 2/3 of Earth's arable land, and threatening global food security. The green growth narrative promoted by some media pundits is scientifically baseless. The fundamental problem is that economic growth increases energy demand faster than we can deploy renewables. Even if we somehow achieved 100% clean energy while growing the economy, we'd still face ecological collapse. With unlimited clean energy, we would simply accelerate other forms of environmental destruction, raising forests, depleting fisheries, mining mountains, expanding industrial agriculture, and generating more waste. Once we understand that flourishing without growth is possible, our horizons expand dramatically. Like the Copernican Revolution made astronomy's math easier, removing growth from the center of our economy makes solving ecological crises more straightforward. High-income nations consume about 28 tons of material per person annually, which must be reduced to sustainable levels. Slowing material use reduces pressure on ecosystems, decreases deforestation and habitat destruction, uses less energy, and requires fewer renewable energy components. Planned obsolescence, designing products to fail prematurely, began in the 1920s when light bulb manufacturers deliberately shortened bulb lifespans from 2,500 to 1,000 hours. Today, household appliances last under 7 years, despite containing components that could easily function much longer. If products lasted 4 times longer, we could reduce material consumption by 75% while improving quality of life. The fashion industry combines advertising with planned obsolescence, creating fast fashion, cheap, disposable clothing designed to quickly become outdated. Americans now purchase 5 times more garments annually than in 1980. Regulations against fast fashion could theoretically cut textile throughput by 80% without compromising access to needed clothing. Astonishingly, up to 50% of global food production, 2 billion tons, is wasted annually. Ending food waste could theoretically halve agriculture scale without reducing food access, cutting global emissions by up to 13% while regenerating 2.4 billion hectares for wildlife habitat and carbon sequestration. Beyond addressing inefficiencies, we must scale down ecologically destructive industries. The beef industry uses nearly 60% of global agricultural land, yet provides only 2% of human calories, while driving deforestation, including Amazon burning. Switching from beef to other proteins could liberate 11 million square miles of land, equivalent to the U.S., Canada, and China combined, allowing reforestation and cutting emissions by 20%. As production becomes more rational and efficient through longer-lasting products and resource sharing, employment in affected industries will decline. This liberation from needless jobs could be managed by shortening the work week from 47 hours to 30 or even 20, distributing necessary labor more evenly while maintaining full employment. Reduced working hours consistently improve well-being. American studies show people working shorter hours are happier regardless of income. When France implemented a 35-hour week, workers reported improved quality of life. Swedish experiments with 30-hour weeks showed better health outcomes and life satisfaction. Research shows those with less leisure time consume more intensively through high-speed travel, meal deliveries, and impulsive purchases. French studies found longer working hours directly correlate with environmentally intensive consumption. With more free time, people gravitate toward lower impact activities like exercise, volunteering, learning, and socializing. To maintain adequate living standards with shorter work weeks, we must ensure wages remain sufficient. This happens partly through the increased labor bargaining power that comes with job guarantees, but we should also implement living wages pegged to the week rather than hour. This means shifting income from capital back to labor, reversing decades of declining labor share of national income. There's ample room for this redistribution. CEO compensation has skyrocketed to obscene levels, from 20 times average worker pay in 1965 to 300 times today. Some cases are even more extreme. McDonald's CEO Steve Easterbrook earned $21.7 million in 2017, while median workers made just $7,017, a 3,100-to-1 ratio. Beyond redistributing income and wealth, we must focus on the welfare purchasing power of income. Take London housing, astronomical prices, $2,000 monthly rent or $600,000 purchase for a basic flat bear no relation to actual construction costs. These prices result from policy decisions like public housing privatization and quantitative easing that inflated asset values. Implementing permanent rent controls, supported by 74% of Britons, would allow people to work less without sacrificing quality of life. This principle could extend to other essential goods, healthcare, education, internet access, public transport, and basic energy and water quotas. Public libraries, parks, and sports facilities become especially important with shorter work weeks, enabling people to spend time in ways that enhance well-being with minimal environmental impact. decommodifying basic goods and expanding commons improves the welfare purchasing power of incomes. Capitalism depends on creating artificial scarcity. Since the 1980s, privatization has imposed artificial scarcity on public goods worldwide: education, healthcare, transport, water, housing, forcing people to purchase private alternatives and work more to pay for them. This logic reaches its height in austerity politics, which deliberately slashes public investment and welfare protections to restart growth by forcing people deemed too comfortable or lazy into greater productivity. During David Cameron's government, welfare cuts were explicitly conducted to get shirkers to work harder. Once we grasp this, solutions emerge. By reversing artificial scarcities, decommodifying public goods, expanding commons, shortening workweeks, reducing inequality, we can render growth unnecessary. People could work less without sacrificing well-being, producing less unnecessary stuff, and reducing pressure for unnecessary consumption. Brazilian photographer Sebastião Salgado spent his career documenting human and ecological trauma, from oil-ravaged Kuwaiti deserts to sprawling refugee camps to Amazon gold mines. After witnessing such devastation, he became sick and lost faith in our species. Returning to his parents' farm in Brazil, which he remembered as a paradise of forests and flowing water, he found it barren and lifeless, destroyed by intensive livestock farming and deforestation. The springs had stopped flowing, the hills eroded, the soil turned to dust. In 1999, the Salgados attempted what everyone deemed impossible, restoring the 1,730-acre wasteland to Atlantic rainforest. Within 6 years, hopeful green covered the land. By 2012, the forest had regenerated, springs flowed again, and wildlife returned, even endangered species. This remarkable story illustrates how quickly ecosystems can recover. Research shows tropical forests can regain 90% of old-growth biomass in just 66 years if left alone, with some recovering in as little as 21 years. These regenerating forests pull over 11 tons of CO2 per hectare annually from the atmosphere. The struggle before us isn't just economic, but about our very theory of being. We must decolonize not only lands and forests, but our minds themselves. For 500 years, capitalist culture has been rooted in a rift of separation from nature. In the late 20th century, phenomenology reintroduced animist principles into European philosophy, and science has followed with revolutionary discoveries about our relationship to the living world. We've discovered that our bodies host trillions of microbial beings essential to our digestion, immune system, and even mental health. Without these bacteria, we couldn't survive. Similarly, trees depend on fungal networks, mycorrhiza, that connect their roots, allowing them to communicate, share resources, and warn each other of threats. Trees recognize relatives, allocate resources accordingly, and even demonstrate emotional responses to trauma through changing serotonin levels. How should we live in light of our scientific understanding of interconnection? Indigenous communities offer guidance through principles of reciprocity, taking only what you need and giving back in return. This stands in stark contrast to capitalism's core logic of extracting more than you return. The ecological crisis demands not just policy changes, but a fundamental shift in consciousness about our relationship with the living world. Degrowth represents more than just taking less. It opens possibilities for abundance through regeneration and reciprocity. It stands for decolonization, de-enclosure of commons, decommodification of public goods, and de-intensification of work. At its core, degrowth asks what we want our material relationship with each other and the living world to be: domination and extraction, or reciprocity and care? We have the power to write a different future if we summon the courage to do so.